Dr. Tusen to testify at our hearings a month ago or something like that, and our communication to him was delayed in the mails, and his commitments at that time also on the short notice that he had would not permit him to testify in front of the committee. He is in town now attending a royalty board hearing, and he does have some ideas that have not been expressed by, I think, other persons who testified in front of our committee. In fact, I'm certain some of his ideas are substantial variants to some of the proposition that we heard. I really intended this to be primarily a briefing for the benefit of the committee as to the possibilities of the Alcan route, what we've been calling the third route, or maybe should be described in some other manner. At any rate, that is the primary purpose of the meeting today. However, I don't want to foreclose any members of the committee raising any points as to previous testimony or as to other points that you think are important, nor do I want to limit Dr. Tusen's remarks to merely that route if you have some comment that you would like to make on the other matters that we discussed at the earlier time. Do any committee members have any suggestions or additions or corrections that you'd like to offer as to the scope of what we're doing today? Okay, Harlan?
Let me start by saying I've got no personal interest in any of the proposed for the Federal Power Commission. I've got no emotional stake in the success or failure of any of them. What I've been trying to do in, with respect to the gas pipeline issue is to contribute some realism in an area, I think, where there's a great deal of unreality in discussions both in the state and nationally. And in doing so, I made some people very unhappy, I realize, as I did in 1970 and 71 when I tried to educate people in the state that there wasn't going to be an oil pipeline until the native claims were solved, until some resolution was made, some provision was made for creation of new national parks and wilderness areas. What I'd like to do, in addition to trying to contribute some realism, is to give an overview of what the gas pipeline problem is, what's likely to happen on the national scale. The time is so limited, I'm inevitably going to have to make a lot of statements simply by assertion, and they may be very controversial statements. I needn't tell you, don't take them on faith. Many of them require considerably more background and discussion. First, one of the things that I think the state should know, the legislature should know, is that the chance of El Paso obtaining a certificate is extremely small, and that the state's ability to affect that outcome is smaller yet. Now, I believe this for a substantial period of time, despite the fact that my report to the governor's task force was part of the foundation for the state's adopting the perspective of favoring a Trans-Alaska pipeline. In that report, I urged the state not to make a commitment to a specific proposal. I urged them at that time the probability of the success of the Arctic gas proposal was much greater, and that the state should devote a considerable amount of attention to trying to foster its interests, to advance its interests, for instance, in maximizing the wellhead value of the gas and in maintaining control over its royalty gas within the context of the Arctic gas proposal, as well as making representations to the FPC in favor of a Trans-Alaska pipeline. And more important than the small practical likelihood of El Paso receiving the certificate is the fact that neither of the systems has any chance of actually being built on the terms proposed by the applicant. And I'll start to develop this proposition, and then that leads into other propositions, and I'll deal with what's likely to happen at the national level, what's likely to happen in Canada and in Washington. And if time permits, I'd like to go back to the issues that were raised in Rush Moody's report and testimony about specific state policy. Any system for the delivery of North Slope gas to lower 48 markets faces a large number of uncertainties and risks. There's the problem of deliverability. El Paso and Arctic Gas are both applying for a certificate and asking that a certificate be issued before it is clear how much gas will in fact be producible on the North Slope or on the North Slope and in the Mackenzie Delta. There's a possibility, I don't know how large a possibility it is, that the proper conservation measures with respect to the North Slope oil will make it unwise to produce to produce from the gas cap at all, or to produce more than say 2 billion cubic feet a day, which is probably the minimum threshold for the construction of either pipeline system. The reserves as yet proved in the Mackenzie Delta are substantially smaller, and any proposal to incorporate the Mackenzie gas is based on even greater speculation about the growth of deliverability in that area. Secondly, there's a great deal of cost uncertainty. The figures submitted to the Federal Power Commission by the applicants are built up in conventional cost engineering techniques, which are almost always low by a great amount in a large custom engineered project that deals with a unique environment or new technology or new scale of operation. And while the figures now being advanced by the applicants are roughly in the order of magnitude of $10 billion, including interest during construction, it would not be surprising if the cost of either project exceeded $20 billion. And so you can make your own judgment as to the likely overrun, but nobody knows what the overrun will be. And both the viability and the ability to finance the project depends upon an evaluation of those probabilities. Thirdly, there is market uncertainty. Both applicants assert in their applications and in their statements to congressional committees that the demand for Alaska gas is effectively insensitive to price. And they posit a system of tariff setting which would in effect make it so. In other words, the cost of Alaska gas, no matter how great it is, would be spread over a broad enough number of consumers and a broad enough and averaged with a large enough volume of other gas, of gas at lower cost from other areas, that would be able to be sold. There are a great number of assumptions both as to the practical economics of the gas delivery system and as to the regulatory regime that are encompassed in this assumption. The Federal Energy Administration estimates on the basis of another set of assumptions that the lower 48 market for Alaska gas in 1985 disappears in the vicinity of $2.40 a million BTU at the city gate. Now, this again is an extreme estimate, but I don't think it's warranted to say that the demand for gas is totally insensitive to price, or to be confident that the FPC and the state commissions will allow an unlimited subsidy by the consumers of this project through raising the price of gas produced from other areas at lower cost. This would be particularly difficult if either gas is decontrolled in the lower 48, or if the Federal Power Commission allows the price of gas from lower 48 fields to go up to something close to what's called the commodity value, roughly the price at which it trades with oil, BTU equivalent basis. I'm saying there's tremendous uncertainty. There are technological, political, regulatory, and management uncertainties, and we can look at things such as, suppose El Paso were to get its certificate next year. There is no way that it can get the clearances from the California Coastal Zone and authority for the terminals and get all the licenses for the terminals. It is a plausible likelihood that no major LNG terminal, no large LNG terminal of the scale that El Paso proposal can be constructed on the California coast. Now, I'm not asserting that, but I'm saying that as a risk that the proposal faces, and that the applicant is proposing to get a certificate and begin the major expenditures prior to the resolution of these problems. Now, so you're facing, I'll mention another risk that, that all of these risks together are imposed upon a system, in either case, whose capital cost is $10 to $20 billion, and neither system begins to carry gas or to recover any revenues until the whole system is in place. That is, the whole investment of $10 to $20 billion is exposed to this total risk. Some of them involve risks of losing money, others risks of non-completion for the entire period of construction. And this is something that the bond market, this is a kind of situation that the bond market just does not produce money to support. The insurance companies and other financial intermediaries who are in effect investing other people's money cannot accept a 30% or a 50% or even a 5% chance that the project cannot service its bonds. Now, let's suppose that the figures submitted by the applicants, the Federal Power Commission, the Department of Interior, and those that are given to the state are both honest and realistic, that they are the most likely values. Well, using these figures, we find that a 30% shortfall in deliverability wipes out either project. A 40 to 50% cost overrun wipes out either project. A 40 to 50 cent difference in the anticipated market price, reduction in the market price at the city gate in the lower 48 wipes out either project. A 2 to 2.5 year stretch out of construction wipes out either project as a viable entity. Assume 85% debt, and you can come up with the numbers of what degree of error means that the project is not going to be able to service its debt, rather than simply meaning that the owners, the equity owners, lose money. And say, well, how likely is it that some combination of these will occur? We could have maybe a 15% deliverability shortfall and a 30% cost overrun, and those two together mean that the thing is not viable, as starting with the applicant's proposals. These are horseback figures, and they're actually no better than the figures offered by the applicants. but they just give you an idea of a way of looking at the risk. Looking at the risk the way the bond underwriters might look at the risk. Now, given all these problems, as one wonders, one can raise the question whether the whether either project is really in the national interest. And this question is being raised. That is, as if it's going to cost $20 billion and deliver a trillion cubic feet per year, or 700 million cubic feet per year, may there not be a way of investing that $20 billion to produce more clean energy in the lower 48 than this one? We're talking about at $20 billion and a trillion cubic feet per year. We're talking about a transportation cost equivalent to $25 to $30 a barrel for oil, these BTU equivalents. You look very hard, and maybe some way of living with the price of OPEC oil doesn't make more sense on a national basis if you accept that figure. So people are beginning to look at those figures, and the bond market will look at it very quickly. Right now, given these risks, the applicants are aware of the risks. They downplay them because in their statements they give you definite numbers for deliverability. They assume that the market for Alaska gas is insensitive to price. But they do propose that somebody else bear the risk. And they propose essentially that the consumers bear the risk through an all events tariff. That is, they propose that the consumers be required, that the tariffs be structured so that the wholesale customers must pay the cost of the pipe, debt service and operating costs of the pipeline, regardless of how much gas is delivered, regardless of how high those costs are, and without regard to interruptions. Now, the proposal by El Paso goes even further and proposes that the consumers be required to pay for the cost of the pipeline even if it's not completed, even if no gas is ever delivered. Now, there's some very serious question whether the Federal Power Commission will accept this concept of an all-events tariff. There is no question in my mind about the reaction of the state utility commissions. For these tariffs to work, the state utility commissions must approve that the retail distributors of gas passing these costs through to the ultimate consumer. Again, regardless how high the costs are, and regardless whether they get any gas. And this is a question nobody had raised. I called commissioners in 9 states just to get a feel for whether they would buy this, and there was not one that said they could vote for approving that kind of all events tariff. Now, I'm not the only one this occurred to. The Treasury, in its submission to the U.S. Senate committees, proposed that there be some sort of federal override so that the states be required to force the distributors to pass through the costs. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's like so much of the rest of this proposal, totally a dream. Now, there are many other problems with these pipelines, but I think this financing one and the all events tariff is at the present time the conclusive stopper. It's a necessary condition, or it's a sufficient condition, that neither one can be carried out. Now, there is, however, another party to guarantee the completion. And in private discussions with the advocates and the officials of both systems, they acknowledge that ultimately there's going to have to be a federal fallback. In fact, I believe Arctic Gas has proposed a federal guarantee on overruns, which of course is has some, raises some substantial problems, and from a national point of view, are you going to relieve from them any incentive to keep the cost down? And that's been the reaction of most of the senators I've spoken to on this question. But since neither of the applicants are willing now to make a proposal for either for a federal loan guarantee for the whole project, for a federal subsidy, for federal equity involvement, they're not making realistic proposals. And there is quite some concern in Congress that Congress is going to be sucked in. That is, that the FPC will certify one of the proposals, that the that Congress will, in effect, be asked to ratify it, and that somewhere down the line, these people will be coming back asking for $6 billion or something like that. You'll have a half-completed pipeline and no finance. And there is a very strong desire on the part of the committee chairman in both houses that all these possibilities be explored before Congress gives its assent to either proposal. Now, this is the background to, or part of the background to, the recent revival of interest in the Alcan route. The Alcan proposal is not a new one. As I understand, back as early as 1970, West Coast Transmission was looking very seriously and publicly talking about building a pipeline from Tok Junction along the Alcan to the head of its system at Fort Nelson. And this has been on the back burner. Bob Blair of Alberta Gas Trunkline hasn't simply come out of the woodwork with the proposal. He advanced this concept when Alberta Gas Trunkline was in the Arctic Gas Group. And there have been, right from the beginning, there have been people who looked at this. It is one of the alternatives studied in the Interior's Environmental Impact Statement. It is an alternative urged by the FPC staff and its Environmental Impact Statement. A very high proportion of the witnesses before the Berger Commission in Canada argued it. Then I spent a couple days at the Berger Commission hearing, and all, it's a small sample. It seemed to me that virtually everybody who lived on the Alcan wanted the pipeline, and virtually everybody on the Mackenzie didn't. And so this has been around for quite a while. And I say what revived it was the focus on this huge front end cost and the tremendous risks of an integrated system that requires $10 to $20 billion before it starts carrying any gas. And so the Alcan was one of the alternatives looked at. Now, even according to the Interior and Arctic Gas figures, the Alcan route itself would be cheaper than the Mackenzie pipeline of the same volume. What makes the Alcan route more expensive in their figures is the assumption that the Mackenzie gas will be brought into the system and that a right-hand leg to the Y will be necessary. That is, to carry a given volume of Prudhoe Bay plus a given volume of Mackenzie gas, there's no question that Arctic gas route is cheaper. But if one looks at the development of the two areas in stages, that is, if one says, well, the Mackenzie reserves are not ripe, the demand for them in Canada is not developed, the amount of reserves are not clear, that you build the Arctic gas line now with a 48-inch pipeline, you're buying a lot of surplus capacity, which is going to cost money before it's put into effect. It is not clear that the present value, the present cost, the discounted cost of building the Alcan and route now, and then either foothills or the right-hand leg of the Arctic gas system, say 5 years later, it's not clear that the second one is more expensive in terms of present dollars. I express no opinion on that. I believe that the Northwest Pipeline and West Coast Transmission people have some numbers on that, and I don't vouch for their credibility, but at least this is the concept. There's another element in the Arctic gas proposal that can be modified, and I believe is proposed to be modified in this new concept or old concept, and that is that Arctic gas proposes to build a series of trunk lines that are physically superfluous. The concept of Arctic gas is an integrated system running from Prudhoe Bay originally to the East Coast and now to the Midwest and to California. In many areas, paralleling or intercepting systems that have excess capacity, or in which the addition of capacity through looping or more pumping capacity would be cheaper than building a new pump line, but trunk line. There are good reasons why Arctic Gas chose the concept of an integrated system. They had to do with the regulatory and bargaining difficulties of moving the gas through existing systems, and intermingling it on the way with Canadian gas, of working displacement agreements that would involve state commissions, the FPC, gas transmission systems, and regions that think that they might lose out either in terms of revenues or in terms of price through any displacement system. I express no judgment on whether they were right. Alberta Gas Trunk Line, West Coast Transmission disagreed with them and went off on their own. They felt that putting it together in stages, putting the Prudhoe gas into the existing systems and expanding it was the more economical way to go. But if you're trying to reduce the front end cost, putting it into the existing system is the and expanding it in small increments is the way to go, and that of course is what these people will probably argue with you tomorrow. There is another concept that has got substantial attention in Washington in the last couple months, and that is the conversion to methanol on the North Slope at Fairbanks, and the use of the oil pipeline to batch the methanol. Unfortunately, this proposal is not nearly as ripe in terms of the ability to as costs it out. I think part of the problem with it is that its corporate sponsor, or it's the consortium that's advancing it, it was under the leadership of a company that was interested mainly in building nuclear submarines to haul the methanol under the ice cap. And this is Westinghouse. Westinghouse headed the consortium looking at the thing, and the people in charge of it were submarine people. And only in the last couple months has there been any really serious attention to the problems and costs of batching it through the pipeline and to what kind of a market you get for methanol delivered through the pipeline. Again, there are some horseback figures. The Oak Ridge Laboratory has done a study of the methanol concept for the FDA. It comes out with a price cost of 29 cents a gallon laid into Los Angeles for methanol, and finds that there is a potential market for fuel-grade methanol as big as enough to consume all the gas on the North Slope. Again, I express no no opinion on whether these are true, and whether it's true, as the Oak Ridge people say, that they use high cost estimates in every point to make the most conservative view of the thing. But the merit of the methanol proposal is that it requires virtually no additional front end capital, that a methanol conversion train can use 25 million cubic feet a day. So you don't need to know that you can tap the gas cap. The conversion trains could be put in small increments as the bugs were worked out and as the market developed. Again, it doesn't need the whole volume of the gas. Conceivably, the state could sell its royalty gas for methanol production while the rest went out through an interstate pipeline. Again, I express no opinion on the costs of this, and I think it's unfortunate that we haven't had a better look than the so-called pre-feasibility study that was done by Oak Ridge, and that we don't have a more credible corporate sponsor for the proposal. And so this is the background. Both proposals are appeal very much to the environmental community. And the environmentalists who at one time, or who a few months ago appeared to be, what I say without any disparagement, an unprincipled coalition with the pro-development interests in Alaska supporting the El Paso proposal, have in a sense have fallen off. The opposition within California to the on safety grounds and on coastal development grounds to the movement of to major LNG ports has in part turned them around. Partly, they've seen the Alcan, which they really wanted all along, really preferred all along, come out as a more credible alternative than it was in the past. Now, I would in watching this development of the Alcan as a new credible alternative and the attempt to find the sponsors for it, I would ask three questions. And on the basis of this, I encourage the environmentalists not to encourage their congressmen who are supporting them, some Midwest congressmen, to put in a bill to authorize an Alcan pipeline. First, are there credible corporate sponsors? Now, suppose West Coast Transmission is willing to build the pipeline through the Yukon and Northwest Pipeline, is interested in providing the lower 48 connection. Who is going to build it in Alaska, and can the group put their ducks together in time to be a credible alternative in the present FPC and National Energy Board proceedings? Or by raising it now, or raising the methanol proposal now, is it not possible you simply abort the present proceedings? There is enough propensity within regulatory commissions to delay and to temporize, and for politicians not to want to make hard choices and to choose a horse that's not in the race because they know they won't have to take the consequences if he wins. Is there enough potential political support for it in Alaska, in the lower 48, and is there a credible corporate sponsor, so that the thing is not just another unrealistic proposal in an already unrealistic arena? And I felt that for those people, there were some a couple senators who wanted to, when they first were introduced by the environmentalists and others to the concept of the Alcan, wanted to amend the the Mondale proposal and to specify an Alcan route to push it through. And the question was, you know, aren't you simply going to delay anything for a couple of months? The second question is what's in it for Canada? And this is a hard question to answer. I have numerous contacts in the Canadian government, and I spent last Thursday in Ottawa trying to get a feel for whether this is a realistic proposal. And let me say about what seems to be the climate in Canada, that the people who count have pretty much decided to go with the Arctic gas proposal. There is a lot of opposition among junior ministers and among staff in Energy, Mines, and Resources, but not on the nationalistic basis. It's not the counterpart to our saying we want a red, white, and blue pipeline. It's not on the basis of anti-Americanism, but basically on the question of whether any of these proposals make sense economically, and skepticism about the reserve and deliverability figures, or a question, say, that we ought to wait a couple of years to make this decision until we see what develops in the polar areas. The nationalism, there's a lot of rhetoric, there's a lot of talk in the press among politicians about nationalistic reasons for not wanting to go with it. In the government, I didn't sense that. People who don't like it because they think it's going to be too expensive, it may not work, and the time is not right for decision. But at so what Canada gets out of the Arctic gas proposal is an early attachment to the Mackenzie reserves, however big they are, and a stimulus to greater exploration in the Mackenzie-Beaufort Sea area. I won't say that it's a cheaper connection. It is in any particular year, it's cheaper. If you've got a bigger pipeline, the cost per MCF moved through it is lower if you're able to fill the pipeline. It may not be cheaper than Alcan plus Foothills, for example, if that additional capacity that serves the Mackenzie is going to be empty for 4 or 5 years or indefinitely. So certainly they get an earlier connection of the Mackenzie, which has an appeal to Canada. It has an appeal to the United States, too, incidentally, because it permits greater exports of Canadian gas through the Mackenzie to the U.S. So I don't want to disparage that one, and give the impression that there are no U.S. reasons to favor Arctic gas over Alcan. But that is the one. On the other hand, and this was the opinion given to me by a number of people, that a proposal by West Coast to extend its system up to the Alaska-Yukon border could be treated not really as an entirely new pipeline system, but as an expansion of West Coast's existing system, and that many of the political, economic, and environmental questions associated with that could be handled much more rapidly than in the case of a system which is designed, a new trunk line which is designed to intermingle U.S. and Canadian gas. And again, I don't know which of these two things is done, and I suspect there's nobody in Canada who would know which of these considerations were done. I was told by people that if West Coast wants to get in before the NEB, they better get their application in within 6 weeks or something like that to be considered in the present proposal. Now, on the U.S. side, the complications are even greater. There is going to be a congressional action on a pipeline in this session. I don't think there's any way of escaping. And I'll treat that in a moment. There was a proposal out of the Senate Commerce Committee staff simply to have a joint resolution or a bill which would direct the Federal Power Commission to consider the Alcan route and the methanol proposal in their current proceedings, notwithstanding the fact that there's no application before the commission. Now, the problem of this is that there's nobody to grant a certificate to if there's no applicant. And second, since you've got an adjudicatory, you've got a quasi-judicial proceeding in which the decision has to be made on the record, in which FPC proceedings allow every intervener to cross-examine every other intervener. As soon as you put a new element into the thing, they've got to start all over again, or you're going to have real due process problems. You have 100 years of litigation on the outcome. If the FPC just now said, we're going to make the decision between these four systems while we've been holding hearings and accepting submissions up to now on two systems. And so that one isn't going to work. It's conceivable that a new application before the NEB this spring could be processed within the time frame that the NEB has set for a decision on Arctic Gas versus Foothills. But it's not conceivable that the FPC in the United States could make that determination. Now, to return to federal legislation, as you know, Senator Mondale and some 30 sponsors have put in a bill to authorize the Arctic Gas system. Senator Stevens has put in one which would direct the FPC to authorize one which does not move to a foreign country. Senator Gravel has one which would reduce the judicial delay. And the administration has put in one that will set a deadline for an FPC decision but the real decision would be made by the president. The FPC would make a recommendation to the president. The president would make a decision. The decision would be reviewed by Congress. And the whole proceeding would be completed within a year. Now, the reason that there is going to be congressional action is that I judge that Mondale proposal, if it came to the floor and it were the only alternative, probably has a majority in the Senate now. And I wouldn't be surprised if there were a majority in the House to authorize the Arctic Gas proposal. Now, this is despite the fact that the State Department and Canadian officials have told Mondale and Ruppey and others many times that such action by Congress would not be in their interest, that would be very hard for the National Energy Board to urge the approval or to recommend approval of Arctic Gas if it looked as if they were doing it on instructions from the United States Congress, and that the timing would be very bad. Neither the Canadians and the U.S. State Department are very concerned. It tells me that since they've told Mondale this several times that Mondale's proposal is one mainly for the benefit of the voters and gas consumers at home, and that basically he wants a procedural bill, maybe along the lines of the Bell bill or along the lines of the administration. Now, the merit of the administration bill, if you propose to consider new alternatives, propose to consider methanol or Alcan, despite the absence of an application, is that you get away from these due process problems. That the FPC can add to its record, and it simply makes a recommendation to the president. The president can consider whatever he wants. He can consider national security, which is something the FPC really can't incorporate into his provisions. He can consider long-term economic relations with Canada, balance of payments, and all sorts of things that the FPC really can't cope with on the record and make part of its decision. He can propose that the system be built by a federal corporation rather than by one of the applicants if he wants. And again, you don't have this litigation over the due process. So the administration bill has tremendous appeal in that sense that it is better designed to minimize litigation than any of the ones proposed by members of Congress. And it also is better designed to allow a serious consideration of the ALCAN alternative. Let me say again, for those who are not members of the committee, because I see some of them here who have been characterizing me as an advocate of that system. I believe now that the question of the ALCAN has come up and has been raised to the point of advocacy that before a Trans-Alaska pipeline or an Arctic gas pipeline can really be seriously ratified, that this one has to be laid to rest. I think that there are a lot of people now who have to be convinced either that the ALCAN is not a superior alternative to the proposal of Arctic gas, or that it doesn't have enough interest in it for Canada that they will do it, and that it is indispensable at this point that somebody, whether it's the president or the FPC, take as hard a look at that as they have at the applicant proposals, or we get into the grant of a certificate, getting a grant of certificate to Arctic Gas, and although right now Mondale might have a majority, turn around and down the line, the people who think that the one that you have a coalition of environmentalists plus the people who want El Paso plus the people who think that the most important one had been or the best proposal had been deliberately ignored by everybody because it was the best, and they'll have if not a working majority, they'll be able to shoot down whatever is necessary, the implementing legislation to make the Victor proposal. So I think it's probably in everybody's interest now that there be some federal legislation that requires FPC to look at this as an equal alternative to El Paso and Arctic Gas. I don't know how to put the methanol proposal in there because it doesn't need FPC or federal approval or federal government approval. If somebody wants to go build a methanol plant and can get the throughput agreements with the owners of the oil pipeline and can buy some gas, they can do it. They don't need any FPC certificates or anything of that sort. Okay. There's one other element that I expect Congress will add. I think that Congress is being responsible to the American people. They will add it. And that is a requirement that when the president sends up his findings or his determination to Congress for congressional review, that he include a finding that the system proposed to be certificated can be privately financed under existing law and existing FPC procedures and according to the tariff and rate-making provisions that will be applicable. And if not, if it cannot be privately financed under those conditions, he must send up at that time his legislative proposals for federal loan guarantees, federal subsidies, federal override of state rate-making authority and things of this sort so that everybody doesn't get sucked into something that they don't see the whole package. Being 2:30, I'm afraid I don't have time to deal with the Rush Moody proposals, and I don't know how long we can, what kind of overrun we can take for the rail.
Do you have any particular questions? Roger.
Then in your best scholarly estimation, is the most viable route existing now on the face of it is the Alaska Highway Trail?
I wouldn't say that, because viability includes political and regulatory viability. I'd say that.
Well, as an economist, then.
As an economist, I can't express an opinion on that viability. I don't know whether the numbers that the West Coast Transmission and Northwest Pipeline are presenting are the right numbers. I think that they deserve very serious scrutiny. That there is they make a prima facie case. This is the way to minimize the front end cost. I see the difficulty of financing that front end cost as the primary obstacle to the construction of either pipe, so that this deserves a lot more serious consideration. I will not go so far as to say that's the one that makes the most sense. I think there's a very strong prima facie case for it.
Senator Tilley. Mr. Bradley, read through.
I've got some more, but I yield the same.
Okay, might it be on the methanol? From what I gathered when I was back in Washington, you don't even need a pipeline. You can convert it to methanol, batch down the oil pipeline, and move that way.
Yes.
It's unregulated, and there's certainly a large enough demand, so the figures that you need then, isn't it? How much of it, your cost figures to actually make it, and market figures and what it will bring?
Well, there are some technical problems about that. There may be technical problems batching through the oil pipeline, and all the people who've looked at it say that it seems on the surface to be feasible. There are some things. You've got temperature regime problems. That what do you do to keep the oil hot while you're waiting for the methanol is going through the pipeline. What happens when you put the methanol, the cold methanol, into a hot pipeline and so on? The thing that, as far as I know, nobody's really done the thorough engineering study that's got to be done. But in concept, I'd agree with you.
Senator Tilley, you through?
Yes.
Bradley, back to you.
Dr. Kissing, are you conversant in the existing gas reserves in South 48? My question is prefaced on that, but my specific question is, everything being equal, if they don't discover any new reserves in South 48, you do know about the reserves, the current reserves in South 48, when, and not left with the Trans-Alaska Highway route, when would our gas be a viable economic commodity? Specifically, when are we going to run out of, when are we going to reach that declining point in gas in Oklahoma and Louisiana and all that to make this boondoggle that you're talking about economically, 10 to 20 million viable,
that depends on too many things that I can't predict. That is, if the price of gas were totally deregulated in the lower 48 states today, the boiler fuel use of gas, which accounts for something like 40% of lower 48 consumption, that is the electric utility and industrial process steam and so on, would be the priority consumers would very quickly be able to bid that away. So you've probably got 10 years in which there's no gas shortage, even out of present reserves, if you had total decontrol and certain changes in the rate-making basis that probably aren't going to occur. Now, decontrol in the lower 48 would also tend to increase expiration in the lower 48. There's quite a bit of disagreement on what the impact of, on just how much gas would come out. Then finally, it might be that the Alaska gas reserves would never be economical to deliver to the lower 48 because it might always be cheaper to manufacture gas from OPEC oil or from coal. And again, I express no opinion since it's so far down the lines, that it's conceivable that it's never going to be economical to transport if it's not economical now. You make whatever assumptions you want to these things. Let me throw in one point that I missed on the way. One of the other obstacles to finance, you'll hear this from the oil companies, and I want you to hear it from me because you can expect to hear it from them. One of the obstacles to financing at this point, virtually anything having to do with energy development in Alaska, is the tax proposals before the legislature. The oil companies cry wolf all the time, and when you propose to increase the severance tax from 4% to 5%, or from 4% to 7%, they said it. The securities analysts are telling people stay away from anything having to do with Alaska until this question is resolved. And the securities analysts are telling people that if Senator Huber's package or Representative Cooper's package is passed, that it simply will be impossible to, that it just won't be worth investing. And this includes the completion of the oil pipeline too. And I say you should hear it from me because, I'm not generally an advocate of those people, and I will tell you where they're giving you a line. This time, I don't think they're giving you a line. That there is some substantial truth to that.
Mr. Speckman.
Thank you, John. Arlen, will you please forgive my failure memory and whatnot, but I have totally forgotten that I've been president of various things you've done over the years. I've totally forgotten whom you represent and how do you, under whose aegis do you do this, these studies in economics and economics?
I've been a professor at the University of Alaska for 11 years. I'm with the Institute of Social, Economic, and Government Research. From time to time during that period, I've been on leave and I've been the chief economist of the United States Senate Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs and of the U.S. Senate's National Fuels and Energy Study. Right now, I'm back at full-time service at the university. About a little over half my time has been under contract to various parts of the state government. The biggest part in recent months has been to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee for a study of electric power. I also, on a part-time, time-available basis, continue to serve as a consultant to the U.S. Senate, to the Senate Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs. Because of my membership on the Royalty Board, I gave Senator Jackson a letter saying that I couldn't in any formal way be involved in any hearings or work on the gas pipeline, say from a national standpoint. But I do, there's no question, I do continue to talk to people about this. I have continuous contact with the people in Washington who are involved.
Thank you.
But basically, the answer is I'm full time at the University of Alaska at ISCGR.
Thank you.
Any other questions of Dr. Tusi? I have one, Mr. Bradley.
Mr. Chairman, I have one real quick one that I've asked some other knowledgeable people. Dr. Tusi, based on your contacts and stuff, I know you're not a geologist, but do you feel that this state is going to, the that they're going to be discovered reserves of oil and gas that surpass the approved obey now in the historic future, you know, for state or for federal. You know, and I think this is relevant about, you know, connecting lines and stuff. And some people think that, you know, there will be a number of, you know, connecting lines in the pipeline. And, you know, if you want to fill up that too as much as possible, and that makes the whole thing go.
I hate to be so evasive. My best answer to that is that I'm not a geologist, but as a layman, I know that the geologists don't know and don't agree as to what the prospect is. That is a layman, whether as an economist or you as legislators, are going to have to start from the premise that there's enormous uncertainty and that your policy should be one directed that doesn't bring disaster down on the state if it turns out there are no future discoveries or if it turns out that this is another Persian Gulf. And I can guess, I don't think my opinion or my intuition as to whether there's another Prudhoe Bay field at Marsh Creek or in the Trillium Reserve or in the Gulf of Alaska, I don't think my opinion is terribly valuable, or my intuition is terribly valuable. What I say is that it's a roll of the dice. The huge fields are, that discovering them are very rare and very random events. But there are some mighty interesting structures up there, and you're not going to know what's in them until you drill them.
Any other questions of Dr. Tusing? Dr. Tusing does have a 2:30 commitment, and it's 20 to 3, according to my watch. I'm wondering, as a matter of fact, I was wanting to meet with the royalty board this afternoon myself because we were going to go over some of the negotiations that have taken place already as to possible gas commitments and so on and so forth. How many people here would like to testify tomorrow if we continue these hearings to tomorrow?
How about just ask questions of Dr. Tusing?
Well, or testifying. Will you be here tomorrow?
Yeah, we'll have a royalty board meeting. We'll have to work out the timing.
Could we try it at 1 o'clock tomorrow?
Well,
how about committee members?
I can't make the commitment.
Well, let me ask you: is there anybody else who wants to testify on their own volition here? Mr. Ward, do you have any comments you want to make?
Well, I have some comments. That was the purpose, I guess, of my being here. Do you want to wait until Mr. Blair comes down tomorrow?
Mr. Blair said that he couldn't make it due to a sudden problem. He had to go to Europe, but there will be four people here from Foothills who will be representing Mr. Blair's interests.
I guess my earlier contact with the committee was, would I like to make some comments as to Dr. Cushing's comments, as well as Mr. Blair's, and I would be appreciative to do that.
All right.
But it'd be better to do the whole thing tomorrow.
It would be better than to wait till after we hear from Foothills people then, I suppose. Well, why don't we, how about committee members? If we start at 1 o'clock tomorrow, if Dr. Tusing can arrange his schedule, fine. If he cannot, we will at least hear from the Foothills people as to what they're thinking about. Is 1 o'clock all right with the committee?
You scheduled Foothills for 3 o'clock tomorrow, so 1 o'clock to 3 would give us time to...
Do you suppose we could get to Foothills before 3 o'clock?
Kate Poland wanted it to be scheduled to 3 because she said she had a conflict with an already scheduled hearing.
Why? Was she going to have their testifying from her committee? Or she just wanted to attend?
No, she just wanted to attend.
Well, I'm afraid I think we better go ahead here at 1 o'clock if we possibly can with the Foothills people and with Dr. Tusing. As I say, the purpose of this thing is to inform the committee as to new developments and new opinions and new possibilities here. So we'll stand adjourned at 1 o'clock tomorrow. 3 minutes.